no time for the open this week.
None just, whatsoever.
We're going to roll right in. If I understand correctly, we're going to roll right in, into the show.
Yeah. Rush hour.
I wrote a very funny line for you.
Okay, I was just spitting out movie titles with Jackie Chan and Chris Tucker.
Oh. I don't know any more of them. Rush Hour 2.
Yeah, I think there might even be a 3.
Ding. Hello and welcome to episode 305 of the Two Hosers Photo Show. My name is Alan in Tübingen, Germany. With me, as always, is
Adam, Vancouver.
Not what I hear. Heard it's Raincouver.
Yeah.
Is that what they're calling it?
It's a lot of rain and
Rainageddon in Raincouver.
Yeah. Yeah.
Are you an umbrella guy or a rain jacket guy?
I'm not an umbrella guy. I'm so kind, sometimes a rain jacket guy, but often neither.
You're out to stay at home and whine about it guy?
No, just go outside, get wet, and that's about that.
Really?
Yeah.
Ew. I don't like remaining wet.
Yeah, I guess it depends on, I don't generally go for just a leisurely stroll when it's pouring rain outside, so just into the car, from the car to wherever I need to be, so.
Car guy. Yeah, see, that's the difference. Like, you're right, I remember when I was living in Canada, in Vancouver, it was a lot more car-centric, and then living here, less so in Europe. My point was, when you do need a new raincoat / umbrella.
Yes.
Raincoat, get it on Amazon.
Sure, why not?
Click through our site. If you need a new umbrella, don't bother with Amazon. Just go to a restaurant and walk out with someone else's.
Okay.
I think that's the move. Just whatever one you like, man. They all get a black one. Everyone has a black umbrella. They'll never know it's theirs.
Well, it's a perfect crime.
Especially if it's raining. So there's that. No, I heard Vancouver set a record. But you were gone.
Yeah, I was in Disneyland.
Yeah, we'll talk about that next week. What did I tell you?
Yeah.
Little shorter show this week. We have a long interview later in the show.
Okay.
So we're going to shorten it up a little bit. Did you shoot anything interesting? Your vacation?
Not counting my vacation? No, I did not.
Okay.
How about you?
I did not go on vacation.
Did you shoot anything interesting, though?
Oh, yeah, that was the question. Yeah. Tell me how you feel about this. I had a part of my ongoing... I have a client that I take a lot of white background portrait shots for.
Okay.
In fact, it's technically two different clients. It's the same guy hired me. He works for both companies.
And he loves white backgrounds.
Yeah, but we do... They're two different kinds. Like, one of them I do, like... basically headshots, but like they use a series of three, like, so it's I take a bunch of shots, the people pick, like the subjects, they pick their three favorite, and I put them in like in a row, right?
Okay.
The other project is they just want one large photo, like a medium shot with a large, lot of white space in it. That's what they want. So two different things, same setup, same studio, you know, white background.
Mm-hmm.
So we schedule as many as we can in a day, and basically have the, you know, everybody come to the house and filter through, and it's about, we give half an hour for each person.
Right.
Since it's not, you know, we're not changing lighting or barely changing lighting. Depending on, you know, which side I'm going to light them from, I'll move the key light. That's about it, though.
Okay.
So I generally get these done in, you know, 5 to 7 minutes. And I'll bang off, you know, 40 quick shots in that 5 to 7, maybe 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And we're good. We're off and running. And then I had one of the ladies, basically, you know, I was done. I had all we needed. And she said, like, after 5 minutes, she said, yeah, I think we should, you know, basically we should use the whole 30 minutes.
Okay.
Okay, what do you want?
You have a conversation about...
Want to play backgammon? Like, wait, I'm going to go ahead and take the exact same shot 150 more times.
Right.
Then what?
I gotcha. Yeah, I think she's really just trying to maximize her one-on-one time with the photographer.
It could be, and I didn't fault her for it, because I think it wasn't coming from a bad place.
No, I don't think so at all.
I just thought, I can't, unless you brought another change of clothes, which some people do, there's really nothing more that I can do here.
Right.
You know, and part of it, too, is this is kind of where, you know, I think you get punished for having practiced and becoming good at your job. Whereas in the past, it might take me, you know, 20 minutes to get to where I want to be. I can get there in 60 seconds now. I don't want to be punished for that and just keep doing it anyways.
Right.
Seems kind of silly, but anyways, yeah, that was kind of a first time.
I understand it to a degree if the individual themselves is sort of paying for the time.
Yes.
So that makes sense to me because... All right, I'm paying X amount of dollars and I expect X amount of time. Whether or not you've got the best shot is sort of irrelevant in that thought process. But in this case, they're not paying directly, right? This is their company paying for this to be done.
Correct.
In which case, I would think you would just kind of want to be out of there as quickly as possible. Not you, the model themselves.
Oh, no, I would too. If I was the quote-unquote model, I would say, hey, if you can get it on the first one, awesome.
let's get out of here.
Hey, were my eyes open? I'm in focus? All right, I'm in the car.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're having this conversation. All you're seeing is a trail of vapor behind me.
Maybe this was their lifelong dream to be on this kind of photo shoot, and now they're finally there, and this is a cool setup. They just want to really, you know, make sure that they get the most of this experience.
Maybe. Sure. I guess. I mean, it's not every day that you're, you know, you are going to a professional photographer's house with a big cyclorama and, you know, giant lighting setup. I get it. For my kids could care less now.
Right.
Like I have, whenever I set this up, I usually think, hey, yeah, you guys want to come downstairs? We'll grab a quick shot for grandma. No. Yeah, we have a studio down there though.
Right.
So anyways, yeah, so that was the first time. And then another little bit of little fun.
So how did it wind up? Did you just finish out the rest of that session just taking shots of the ceiling?
I took a few more shots of her, but sort of made it socially clear that, we're all done.
Okay.
And fortunately, the next person was 10 minutes early, so the doorbell went. And so that kind of ended things.
Perfect.
Which was nice, yeah. So that kind of worked out. You know, and like I said, it's a good client. I have no complaints. It's just one of those things where I was kind of caught off guard and thought, I don't know what to say here.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So on a different note, photography-wise, though, bought a fog machine.
Right.
We talked about this,
yeah.
Yeah, no, I pulled the trigger. It's awesome.
Okay.
Love it. Have you bought one yet?
No. They're quite a bit more expensive here than what you had originally anticipated.
Really?
Yeah. The cheapest I've seen was one, a sort of mini fogger that they called it at Canadian Tire, which was retailing for about $60. And then you still have to buy the liquid, the fog liquid. Yeah. So another $15 or something for that. So yeah. And I just quickly poked around in Canadian Tire the day after Halloween to see if there was anything on clearance and did not see anything. So same deal with Amazon. Everything's pretty expensive as far as the Canadian versions of these. So it might be on my Christmas list. I might have to wait for someone else to buy it for me.
I mean, you know, mine was generally in line when you do the conversion into Canadian dollars. It's around that price. But in euros, I think it was... We'll talk about it on the fog machine dedicated show.
Okay.
But it's around 40 euros or something like that. But I bought the more expensive one because I figured, you know, you don't want to get sucked into buying the 20 euro fog machine.
Right.
That's going to work twice.
That doesn't sound good, yeah.
Yeah. So anyways, so far loving it though. So I'll I'll post a couple pictures that I took, convinced my kids to sit in for 8 seconds before my son got too scared and left. Yeah. Okay. So, the photo challenge this week, I thought I picked an easy one, and then I sat down and thought, hey, this is a lot of work.
Okay.
Didn't you think so?
I did mine in about 2.5 minutes, so.
Yeah, but you were forced to.
Yes.
Had you really sat down with it, I think you probably could have fallen into the rabbit hole and.
Probably, yeah. I probably could have. I just went with needed something immediate, so.
Yeah.
Let's start with mine in that.
It was a scheduling situation, and that's where we're at. So let's have a look at yours. This is based on your vacation that you just got back from.
Yep.
Which I kind of knew going in. That's why I figured you might have a shot that you could use to make a movie poster. So tell us about the movie poster.
I did not shoot this with movie poster in mind. In fact, as you will see, I am in the photo. So I handed this off to one of the Disneyland photographers who stands by and takes pictures. But I can barely
see the selfie stick here.
Yeah, so you can do that anywhere. They're very friendly, and even though they're taking their pictures for the online version that you can buy, they will happily take your photo if you just hand them your camera. Mm-hmm. So as we discussed, I'd taken the point-and-shoot camera, which I was happy to hand off, and you know they snapped a couple of photos of us in this very popular spot where you've got the statue of Walt Disney and Mickey and him behind the castle, and I just saw it as enough headroom that it could easily be turned into a movie poster, which is why I selected this image.
No, that's, you know, had you shot it on purpose like this, that would, you know, that's what you're looking for. Enough, you know, white space or, you know, not technically white space, but enough blank space that you can put the font in.
Right.
So, no, I like it. The guy working there, the Disney guy, did you have to crop this very much?
No, very little. Yeah, just get a few people out of the sides because, of course, it's Disneyland. Mm. So you're always going to have people around and walking through your background, and that's just an impossibility to get everyone out. So this was I was pretty happy with the fact that there's no wildly distracting people. There was a guy sitting camera right on that whatever you want to call it. Bench-ish thing that I cropped out, and that's about it.
I was going to say the guy who works there clearly knows what he's doing. I think this is a rare good photo from a stranger.
Yes, I agree. I've never had so many strangers take our photo because I was easily handing my camera off to any guy that worked for Disneyland, and yes, most of them do not look like this.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. Most of them are, you know, feet cut off or weird angle, or they've tried to do something artistic that doesn't work.
Oh, don't do it. Don't do it, film school guy. You're a failed film school guy.
Yeah. So I really did. This was towards the end of our trip, and I really did think, okay, this was how I would have shot it, more or less.
And that's Neuschwanstein Castle in the background?
Yeah.
Good.
So there you go. There's my poster. Would you have any feedback as far as font or positioning or taglines?
No, that's two different fonts, correct?
No. I think it's the same font.
The vacation, that looks like a very different font.
Maybe it is. I don't know. I, again, whipped it up in 2 minutes and I don't even remember.
It might not be. I stretched one out.
I think it's the same font, but yeah. I didn't consciously change the font if the font is different.
No, I think it is the same font. No, that's good. I mean, I honestly want to be too critical because I know how much time goes into an actual movie poster, and how much lead time you had for this. 3 minutes?
Yeah,
if that.
So, yeah, might have been four, but yeah.
No, all in all, I think we get the message.
There you go. So, all right.
I didn't put as much time into mine either. As a matter of fact. I had something wildly different in mind, and I didn't even shoot this photo specifically for a poster. I just happened to look at it and thought, wow, I bet you this could be a movie poster. And I might be wrong, but we'll talk about that in a minute. So there you go.
Okay. So this is looking like a polarizer?
Yeah.
Okay. and your son?
Correct.
Okay, there we go. So
my suggestion to you is when you're shooting this time of year, get yourself a polarizer and my son.
Okay.
And you can't go wrong. No, this was yesterday. We decided we're going to go for a walk in the countryside, which is nice because we live in the countryside. And my kids wanted to go and basically steal apples. There's a whole bunch of apple orchards. People just have apple orchards near our house.
Mm-hmm.
And this time of year, you can just walk around. It's not actually stealing. They encourage it. You can go walk around and help yourself to an apple if you like, off the tree.
Right.
So my kids wanted to do that, and so that's what we did. Went for a little walk, and I said, you know, it's funny because I've been shooting the fall colors. I'm going to go out today and just specifically shoot black and white because it's, you know, it's, we've already had daylight savings here. We do it a week earlier than North America, so it gets dark really quite early, which also means magic hour is really early. And so I know I'm going to get some really cool looking light. What if I take a polarizer, shoot black and white, like black and white JPEGs even. Mm-hmm. I shot JPEG and RAW, but I dial it right in with high contrast JPEGs right in the camera. And I'm going to take a yellow filter, like an actual physical yellow filter, and wind that on as well. So I'm really going to commit. Turns out I've grabbed the wrong filter and actually brought an 85B, which is kind of like a little different than yellow, but I'm colorblind, so I just grabbed it by accident.
Mm-hmm.
So it didn't get quite the same effect in black and white, but it did get kind of an effect. Basically changed the color temperature by making it kind of orangey. But that's baked right in, so I'm getting that effect right in camera. So this is essentially right out of the camera is what you're getting here. That's the shot. And then chose it because of the exact what you talked about. There's enough headroom. We can add some font. We can, you know, draw the eye to where we want to and still have a decent photo. And you can read everything that you want.
Nice. Yeah.
That's it.
Like it.
Is it a movie poster? I don't think so. I think it's more of a book cover.
Okay, sure. Yeah. Yeah. Except for it says based on the novel by Stephen King, which would be weird for a book cover.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was actually going to have a little joke where I wrote it S-T-E-V-E-N, and I figured people would just point out that, you know, that's not how he spells it.
Right. Gotcha.
That was the point. I said that not the Stephen King, just a Steve.
Random King. Random Steve.
That would be funnier. But other than that, I think I may have broken one of the rules in that this has three fonts. That's why I asked about yours having the one.
Okay. Yeah.
This has three, which, it's not the end of the world, I don't think.
Okay.
So, there's that. That's where we are. Okay, topic this week. It's an interview. As I've probably mentioned a million times in the show, I worked on, I worked with the crew at Corolla Digital a couple of times, and one of the movies I worked on called The 24-Hour War is available now for pre-sale, just coming out. I'm told it's 22nd of November, I think, is the unofficial release date when you're going to get your when you can see it on iTunes.
Okay.
And in anticipation of that, I spoke with one of the directors, one of the producers, one of the writers, Nate Adams, who I'm sure if you listen to Adam's show, you probably know the Adam Carolla show. I'm sure you know who Nate Adams is.
Yep.
He's, like I said, writer, producer, director at Corolla Digital, responsible for producing Road Hard, co-directing Winning, the racing life of Paul Newman, and now The 24-Hour War. And so I sat down with him via telephone because he's in Los Angeles, and we had a little talk about, well, the movie, directing, how he got to where. Tell you what, you'll hear what we talked about. No, you, Adam, you'll hear.
Okay. Yes, I will.
All right. All right. Without further ado, here's me and Nate Adams. We can't even reference that now.
Okay.
So now we're starting.
All right.
From right on now. We're already doing this. Nate Adams, I already gave you your big intro on the first part of the show.
Great.
Just so you know, I'm bad at intros, Nate.
Apparently so.
You're done. Nate Adams from Hollywood, California. Nate, how are you?
I am living the dream, as I like to tell people. Living the dream.
I think you are living the dream, to be honest. If I know you think you're kidding, but this really is the dream. But let's get to Noah. First of all, big news this week, probably available for pre-order right as you're hearing this, The 24-Hour War.
Yes.
Co-director, producer, man about town. Tell us a little bit about The 24-Hour War.
The 24-Hour War is a feature-length documentary, and it is chronicling the story of Ford and Ferrari in the 60s. It's really the tale of two icons, Enzo Ferrari and Henry Ford II. And they basically, got in a pissing match, and the battlefield was Le Mans. And it all started because Ford was doing very poorly and getting sort of beaten up, in the showrooms and on the track a bit by the Corvette in America. And they didn't have any like slick, cool race cars or any even cool street cars like the Corvette. The closest thing they had was a Thunderbird. And that's, if you've ever seen an old Thunderbird, they're not that cool. Right. So basically Henry Ford, thought, hey, the best racing company in the world and the most beautiful cars in the world are Ferrari, so I'm going to buy Ferrari, and that will solve a lot of problems.
It's an amazing story, actually. What I like the best about it is I'm not a car guy. I'm not a car guy, though. But as soon as, getting on the crew with you guys, and especially Adam and some of those guys, they're crazy car guys. And so for them, this is a great story. But the beauty of this story, I find, is that it's universal. Like, it really is an amazing story if you don't know how to drive a stick shift.
Yeah.
But getting back to you for a second, I kind of wanted to find out about who is Nate Adams. Where did you start? How did you get to where you are now? Like, you have quite a long resume.
Yep.
Where are you from?
I am from a little state, a big state with not a lot of people, called Montana.
Uh-huh.
And I grew up in the 406, in a small little tiny town in the middle of nowhere called Haver.
Mm-hmm.
And, grew up, had the best childhood ever. Worked on a ranch every summer, grew up hunting and fishing.
Did a little wrestling.
Did a lot of wrestling.
Mm-hmm.
That was, that's what got me. We were very poor, so I kind of knew that the only way I was going to college was to get a scholarship. So, I won 3 state championships in high school in wrestling and got a full ride college scholarship. And that's how I went to college.
And where'd you go to college?
In Montana.
In Montana. So yeah. Going from, how did you get from Montana to Hollywood? When did you make that move?
I had an interesting life growing up. And so, everyone always thought, of course, hey, this guy's just going to be a wrestling coach. And, that's what all my friends in college, in Montana right now, pretty much almost every high school is populated with a guy from my college wrestling team as the head coach.
Okay.
It's really fun to go back. For me, the biggest thing that happened, is I had a lot of problems with drugs and alcohol growing up. So I kind of in high school, I got sober and kind of steered me in a different direction and opened up my eyes to trying different things.
Mm-hmm.
So in high school, it's really funny, growing up in a rural area, unfortunately, especially where I grew up in the 80s, the theater kids get picked on. And so I started doing this play when I was a senior, and none of the kids in the play would sit by me, even during rehearsal. And I'd grown up with these kids my whole life, but I'd never talked to any of them, and they didn't know me either, other than school or whatever. And then for the first 2 weeks, they wouldn't even sit in the area that I was sitting in. And then after a couple of weeks, I was so bored. I talked to this, there was another one kid who used to wrestle for a few years growing up. And his dad was a big wrestling fan and a teacher. So I sat next to him and talked to him, and he's like, and I was like, well, why wouldn't, haven't you guys talked to me for 2 weeks? And they're like, well, we're very scared of you because I have a very bad reputation. So nobody wouldn't sit by me. So anyways, I started to really, you know, I really liked these kids, and I ended up like protecting, I ended up making, you know, stopping anybody from picking on any of these kids anymore in high school. And I really liked doing plays, and I really liked that creative atmosphere, you know. And even when I went to college and wrestled in college, I kept on doing plays. I kept on acting plays, and, you know, I really liked it. And I just, you know, I enjoyed the creative part of it, of reading plays. And then I realized I liked writing, and I liked the, you know, I just liked the storytelling part of it. So after college, I moved to Portland, Oregon, and I did a few roles in some films, like low budget films, that one of them that was a lead in the movie. Still, I don't even think the guy ever finished it to this day.
Right.
I've been in like three of those. But then, you know, I kind of just after a few years in Portland realized that if I'm going to take a shot, I got to come to LA. So I just moved to LA. I didn't know anybody.
This was what, approximately what year?
This is like in the, you know, 96.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So moved to LA, know a soul, nothing, you know, no money, no nothing. Lived in Watts, which if you know Los Angeles, I probably shouldn't have made it out of there.
Sure.
But it was the only place I could get an apartment for $300 a month in Los Angeles, which I could barely afford that. And then I had one friend who was a friend of a friend, but he was going to give me a chair. Like I'd lived down there for like 2-3 months. And then he was like, going to throw this chair away. And I was like, don't throw that chair away. Let me have it. I don't have any furniture. And he came down there to give it to me. And he was like, you can't live here. You're going to die. He's like, I have a spare room. Live in my spare room for $300 a month. Just said, I don't want your blood on my hands.
Wow.
So I ended up I lived in a nicer place in Hollywood, which was great. Which helped a lot. So long story short, then I did a fair amount of acting, but constantly writing. And then I wrote a screenplay, which got a lot of notoriety around town and kind of made a pretty big splash and got optioned many times and almost made many times and got me a big agent. And I started doing more writing and rewriting for other people's scripts. And
when you say it was optioned, what does that mean to people who don't know?
Okay, an option means, you know, it's a certain amount of money to option a screenplay for a certain amount of time in order for someone to try to get the money together to make it. So
like a hold.
Yeah, so somebody might give you $5,000 against $200,000. You know, they'll give you $5,000 now. It's like earnest money if you buy a house, you know. Right. So they're giving you some earnest money to say, hey, but also to say you can't, you know, try to make this movie with someone else. You know, like I'm serious about it. So I'll give you $5,000 for 12 months, mm-hmm. 6 months, 18 months, whatever the deal is that you make to hold it. And, you know, while they try to raise the money, get the actors, do whatever they need to do. I mean, that script I'd been so far at one point where – we had Gary Oldman and we had a director named Alan Rudolph, and we were literally location scouting, and then it fell apart like as we were like in pre production.
Wow.
It
never got made.
No. I will actually at some point probably make it myself.
Mm-hmm.
So basically then, you know, around 2005 ish, I was, you know, doing a lot of writing and my buddy, who was a big fan of my writing, was starting a fight company, and he said, hey, I want to make a countdown show, which is like the pre-fight show. You know, it's like a half-hour sports documentary about the fighters. And at that time, like 24/7 had never come out or anything yet. And he said, so, you know, but I want to do it really differently. I want to, you know, kind of a storyteller person to do it and get deep into the lives of these guys and actually have people care about them instead of just having, you know, a bunch of guys punch bags and say, I want to kick this guy's ass, mm-hmm. you know, because that gets boring. So, and he said, you know, do you think you could produce something like that? And I said, of course I can. No problem.
Always say yes.
Yeah. I said, of course I can. And I had no idea what I was doing. So
at this point, you have no film, like film editing, shooting, filmmaking experience.
I think I'd made a short film with my friend at that point. You know, I think I'd sort of co-produced and co-directed the short film. And then he ended up like sort of stealing it away from me and not like, giving me half a credit. But that's another story. Welcome to Hollywood. And we're not friends anymore, by the way. So
I have him online too. Hang on. Ian, go ahead.
I'd love it. So I got my buddies who were Academy Award nominated filmmakers who are here kind of, they'd just gotten here. We had the same agents and we were a good friend. We were, you know, just kind of had a relationship, and they had a few months where they were kind of waiting around before this script was supposed to go that they were going to do. And I knew that they'd made some documentaries, and I was like, hey, why don't you guys do this with me and we'll make this thing, you know? So we made this half an hour film, and it ended up getting put on Showtime. And then the head of Showtime Sports called me and said, hey, that was our highest rated sporting event for the whole month. You know, more people watch that than all of our boxing stuff or anything else. And he said, and then Showtime started doing boxing and then, or MMA, sorry. And then the company that they were doing it with hired me to make their shows. So I started making their shows and then, you know, independently. And then they brought me on full time to do all their shows, commercials and everything else. So then I did all those. You know, and then I did a bunch of reality TV stuff and got hooked up with Adam Carolla.
Reality TV is kind of, it gets, I don't know, is there a kind of a stigma to reality TV, except the reality of it is an amazing training ground for filmmaking skills.
Yeah, reality TV is, to me, it's a little bit like the Wild Wild West. Mm-hmm. I mean, I encounter a lot of people who have a very, low skill set to me, who work in reality TV, where I'm like, wow, I don't understand how you
are
here.
How are you hired? Yeah.
Yeah. But it happens because, you see this in Hollywood a lot. It's people amazingly fail upwards in Hollywood a lot, where you get people at a certain level and you're like, I don't know how you got here. You know,
I've worked on a couple of reality TV shows as well, and one of the things that struck me was that, like, if you know a few different skills, you're in immediate demand. Like, if you can do sound and maybe help with the lighting, or like you're working so many angles. There's not so many defined roles as there is on like a Hollywood film set, where if you're a grip, you're a grip.
It's a huge, you know. I've produced feature films as well, and the difference is, It's night and day. It's not the same, you know, on a significantly closer to a documentary. And, you know, on a reality show, you might only have five crew members. On a feature film, there's probably 50.
Right.
So it's a very different atmosphere. And things are very slow in a feature film compared to, you know, I mean, in a reality show, you might have 3 to 4 days to shoot a 60-minute episode.
Right. Yeah, sure. I would recommend to people starting out who want to break in the business, go try to get on a reality show. Like, it's trial by fire, but you will get access to a lot of things really quickly. Whereas if you're a PA on a film set, on a Hollywood film set, you're going to be picking up cigarette butts for 6 months. Likely.
Yeah. I mean, if you know, a film set, I see that a lot, and I completely agree with you. Actually, I would definitely say, you know, I've seen a lot of kids here who are like, oh, film snobs. And truthfully, I wish for me that I would have actually got into reality stuff earlier, because it's so much easier to get hired. And you know, like I said, the bar is lower. And if you're good at what you do, you will rise quickly.
Yes.
And if you work hard, you will rise quickly. And the, you know, what I always tell people, like, hey, if you want to go to Hollywood, learn how to edit. If you're a good editor, you're always going to get paid and you're always going to be in demand. Mm-hmm. And you can still work on being a filmmaker. You can still work on, you know, if you want to be a director or whatever else you want to be. Most people want to be a director, of course. But, you know, you can constantly be working on that, but you can actually make a living.
If you are a good editor and get on a reality show, all of a sudden you are a director and a writer at the same time.
Yeah, you do a lot of what they call – they call it a predator, which means a producer-editor.
Right.
Which means you're kind of in there. You make a lot of decisions because they have to pound out a show every 7 days mm-hmm. and deliver. So they, you know, you only have so much time in a day if you're the producer or the EP of that show. So, you know, people just have, you know, you have to allow other people to make serious story decisions. And when you find good editors who are good at story, you never let them go. Because I've been working, you know, straight producing for a good 10, 12 years. And I can count the good editors that know story that I've met on one hand. Mm-hmm. I mean, literally, and I've probably worked with 200 editors. And I only have maybe 4 or 5 that I would say can do both. The rest are button pushers.
Sure.
In my mind. So they're very, some of them are very expensive button pushers, but you know, it's a very having a background in story, and almost every person like that I have met is a screenwriter mm-hmm. and an editor. So they are a screenwriter and they have spent a lot of time writing scripts and they understand story and they study story, and it really makes them a great editor.
So you go from reality TV, then how do you meet Adam Carolla?
I met Adam Carolla through a good friend of mine. So I produced and directed this short film that was just kind of a fun – I was testing this high-speed camera and making a commercial for the company that made the camera. Believe it or not, it's a German company.
Okay, cool.
Called – of course, it just completely slipped my mind. P&S Technic.
Don't know it.
Yeah. Actually, I think that camera kind of sank them.
Okay.
Because it was a very expensive handmade camera. Now, they did completely sell out all of the cameras once they showed the high-speed stuff that I had done. Mm-hmm. So I basically made a high-speed kind of MMA little fun short with real punches and kicks for them.
Okay.
And you know, very little story, but high production value, brought in a lot of favors from some of my commercial buddies and stuff. And Adam liked that. And Adam knew my buddy had talked me up as a writer. So Adam and I were talking about screenplay ideas to write together. And then he kind of came up with the idea for Road Hard and said, why don't you produce that, and I'll bring in Kevin Hench, and we'll co-direct it. And Kevin Hench was Adam's old writing partner. They'd done The Hammer together. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of how – and then as we were talking about things, he said, you know, I have all these Paul Newman race cars, and I want to do a documentary about him. And I've approached ESPN about it, and they didn't want to do it because they didn't believe it was a real documentary. And I said, well, let me see what material you have. And I watched some of the material that he had and listened to some of the stories. And I said, there's definitely a documentary there. And I said, you know, I've made all these sports docs, you know. And he said, oh, well, awesome. Let's do that too.
And so, that the name of that movie is?
Winning the Racing Life of Paul Newman.
Which I've seen. I actually saw long before I even met you or knew who you were, and loved it. Highly recommend checking that out as well.
Yep, you can get both. So right now, Adam and I started a new platform called chassis.com. It's an automotive distribution platform, and that's where we have the 24-hour war. You can pre-order it now. We also have Winning the Racing Life of Paul Newman. You can buy a DVD, get a digital download, And we will be putting up a lot more automotive content there that we're acquiring. I've also acquired a movie called The Bug Movie, which is the history of the Volkswagen Bug.
Okay.
With starring Ewan McGregor. And that'll be coming very soon. And I've got quite a few other automotive documentaries that I'm loading up on that site as well.
I do want to get into that because, like, that's actually fascinating. I'm thrilled for you guys that you're going down that road. But first, so you put together Road Hard, you do the Paul Newman movie. How do you come on to the 24-hour war? How does that get to you? How does that pique your interest? Who starts? You or Adam?
There's a guy that wrote a book called Go Like Hell. His name is AJ Bame. Mm-hmm. And we all loved the book. And basically at that time that Brad Pitt and Tom Cruise were kind of circling and had even optioned the material, one of their companies. So everyone, you know, was like, oh, it's going to, you know, that's what got everyone interested in the book, I think. And then we read the book and said, well, you know, we could never make this as a feature. This is way too expensive, but what an amazing documentary this story would make, the story of Ford and Ferrari, you know, going to war at Le Mans and Enzo Ferrari and Henry Ford II, you know, going toe-to-toe. I mean, kind of, I didn't really finish the description earlier, but basically, you know, the short version is Ford and Ferrari went through negotiations with Ford was going to buy Ferrari for $15 million. And at the very end, Enzo Ferrari basically kind of spit in their face a little bit. And a lot of people speculated he was never going to sell to them in the first place because he didn't want his Italian company to go to an American, to go to the Americans. Mm-hmm. And at that time, he'd been winning Le Mans 9 out of 10 years. And Henry Ford said, fine, then we're going to come to Le Mans and we're going to beat you. And we're going to, you know, beat you where you live. So he built a race car called the GT40. And for the first couple of years, Ferrari spanked him. And then in 1966...
Wow, you got to watch the movie to find out.
Oh, yeah. Okay, that's true. So, you know, and it was, it's a great story, you know, because it's these sort of titans of the automotive industry just really going to war through cars.
But this all took place over 50 years ago. How do you dive into this? Like, where do you start? You archive footage? You start getting interviews? How does this begin?
Yeah, I mean, that part of it is always kind of a you know, it's a crazy sort of process. And, you know, what you do or, you know, what I do first is I go, okay, you know, this is 50 years ago. How many of these guys that were there are still alive? And how can I interview them? Mm-hmm. So that's where you start. I mean, you know, and this documentary is great. And you came on the shoot with me because it's the first time that Ferrari participated in a documentary or anything on this subject matter. So we went to Italy and interviewed Piero Ferrari and Mauro Fiorgheri and Carlo Tazzioli from Ferrari. So anything I've ever seen on this subject matter really only generally has a little bit of Ford's side, mm-hmm. you know, and none of Ferrari's side. So the thing that I really love about this and am proud is that we really represented Ferrari's side of the story. And Ford's side, of course, you know, we got Dan Gurney and Henry Ford III and Edsel Ford II and Bob Bondurant and, you know, all the sort of heavy hitters that we could from the U.S. And we have a lot of vintage Carroll Shelby and stuff like that. So that was not as difficult to rep as, you know, the Ferrari stuff. So it took me a year to get an interview with Piero Ferrari. And that I thought was a great accomplishment.
It was actually kind of fascinating to be there. That was one of the shoots I was on with you, getting to go into the factory in it was Modena, correct?
Yeah, Modena.
Well, so it took you over a year to get him.
Is the factory in Maranello?
I think that's where it originally was. I think I don't remember now.
Could be we went to both those cities. One had the museum and one had the factory.
Yes, that's right. Well, there's two. I think there was two museums, but we went to the original. Yeah, I'm not sure now.
Okay. It was a fun shoot.
It was a great time. I mean, just and you're right. It seemed like you don't see much of, you know, Ferrari participating in much of anything. And they were very welcoming and really kind of open to this, to telling the story.
Yep. Yeah, it was really cool to, you know, just to go inside, you know, where we interviewed Piero was in the archive room at Ferrari. And it had literally, you know, every single drawing and write-up about every car mm-hmm. in the history of Ferrari. It was amazing to be in there. And out the window, you know, behind Piero in the interview, if you see the documentary, is the restoration shop where they are literally, you know, restoring these multi-million dollar Ferraris from every era of Ferrari.
Right.
So, I mean, you couldn't have asked for a more amazing interview spot.
It really was cool. And like I said, I'm not the crazy car guy, but I knew being in there it's kind of rarefied air just to be allowed in there.
Yeah. The fact that they even let us in there was crazy.
Yeah, but quite an exciting experience. And so I think what's pretty amazing to me is that, I mean, you did interview people from all around the world. I mean, we were in England the summer before. And how many interviews did you hit at Goodwood? Like, was there 12 old racers maybe?
Yeah, we hit quite a few interviews there. I think we interviewed, you know, at Goodwood we interviewed Jack Sears, John Surtees, Brian Redman, Richard Atwood, Alan Grant, Jackie Oliver, Henry Mann. And I think that's pretty much all of our guys that we got there. But it was really – that was really – you know, it was fun. That's probably from a technical perspective, that was the loudest – those were the loudest interviews I've ever had to – you know, when you do interviews, you are always really trying very hard to make sure that, you know, you have perfect sound. And it was – I call it planes, trains, and automobiles. There's always planes, trains, and automobiles mm-hmm. messing up your sound in interviews. And literally when we were there, they had Spitfire airplanes taking off right outside, helicopters landing constantly, and also race cars driving by every 2 seconds. So and then where they put us was in the driver's tent. So there was like a dinner party happening 20 feet behind us. So it was just a disaster of sound constantly. So
it was the toughest shoot I'd ever been on, actually. And also, I mean, you have these guys that, and you know, I felt a lot of pressure, and I know Kevin did. I mean, you guys flew all the way over for this, and these, it's not like John Surtees and the rest of these guys are hanging out every second weekend. So to get them all together in the same place, you know, at once, it's not that easy to do. And so I know we really didn't want to let you guys down in that tough spot, but hopefully it worked out.
Yeah, I mean it was really, you know, it was literally our only way to get all those guys together. Mm-hmm. You know, we couldn't afford to go run around England and interview them all separately. So that was the only way to do it.
So you got that. You have all the old footage locked in. I've seen the trailer. If you haven't seen the trailer, check it out online. It really is fantastic. I'm not just saying that because I know you or was part of this. Great trailer. Specifically love the music. The music really puts it all together.
Yep. It's on iTunes. You can go see it there. There's a food truck right behind me if you hear that honk.
I've told everybody to go check it out, of course. But just real quick before we wrap it up, you said you have a new what is chassis.com?
Chassis.com is a distribution platform. It's an automotive based distribution platform where you know, basically car enthusiasts, men and women who love cars and all, you know, car stuff, can come and find really high level quality produced content. You know, it's most, if you watch a lot of the car documentaries and car stuff, then, you know, they're just so poorly produced generally.
Mm-hmm.
And poorly made, because either it's made by a car guy who knows everything about cars and nothing about filmmaking, or it's made by someone who has a sort of a decent level of filmmaking but knows nothing about cars.
There's very little overlap there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we kind of represent the best of both worlds, with Adam being an absolute connoisseur of cars and very knowledgeable, and me just having a very, you know, deep foundation in documentary filmmaking and filmmaking in general.
But you chose to just essentially distribute this movie by yourself.
Yes, we are distributing this by ourselves 100%.
Because
we realized that, you know, we distributed our last feature film, Road Hard, Starred Adam, and Winning the Racing Life of Paul Newman with a conventional distributor. We just realized, like, the fees and everything they were charging were so exorbitant, and we realized that, you know, we had the marketing platform, you know, Adam has a podcast that has over 1 million people that download it every day, and, you know, Adam goes on Howard Stern and Jimmy Kimmel and all these things without – he doesn't need assistance from anyone to do that.
Right.
Plus, everyone knows Adam is a car guy. Adam races cars himself. Adam has a massive car, vintage car collection, and he races them. And, you know, he is an authentic guy in that space, just like, you know, like Jay Leno. I mean, in Adam, you know, we go to Jay's and screen all of our docs for Jay, you know. And so we realized that, why are we giving away, you know, such a big chunk of everything,
mm-hmm.
you know, for other people who really aren't, they're just not really going the extra mile. It's like, you know, when you do your own work on something, you handle it so much better than someone else would if you're one of 50 other thing, you know, cars they're sure. painting. You know,
this is why I was really thrilled to hear that you guys were going this way, because it's one thing to produce your own films and shoot them and you know, get the financing. Like, that's not tremendously rare. It's not easy to do. I'm not suggesting that it's a simple thing to do, but there are other examples. But the whole distribution network has sort of been the linchpin in this independent film. Like, you still had to figure out how to get asses in the seats, right?
Yep.
So for you guys to do this, and this is one of the reasons that I've worked with you guys 3 times now, I absolutely love working with and for you guys. Just because of I mean, like, just to cut back to like how I got the job in the first place was I listened to Adam's show. And being over here in Germany, it's great because you can, you know, there's no, you know, international boundaries. You can hear his American show here in Germany. It's fantastic having that kind of content. But, you know, I guess probably close to 2 years ago, I heard on the show it was, hey, yeah, we're going to go do something in England. And that was it. That day I got in touch and probably with Gary, and Gary said, here, talk to Nate. And it was that simple. And I said, okay, great. I want to come, you know, whatever it is, I want to come work for you guys. That's what I want to do. Now, on the one hand, I'm obviously a fan of Adam's, like his podcast, etc. I never, ever, ever would have shown up in England or whatever based on that. Like, that was a separate thing. But the opportunity to work with you guys because of what you do, and more importantly, how you do it. You guys are the model for moving forward. Like, this is how it's going to go. And I think that whether you get credit or not, and I hope you do, you'll get credit for being you guys are the trailblazers on this kind of marketing.
Yep. Well, we're trying to do, you know, we're trying to create our own sort of niche site for car people. And put a bunch of content there that's sort of curated and manicured by us, as well as our own content. I mean, we're doing a new documentary on Willie T. Ribbs, who's the first black driver in the Indy 500. We're doing another one on the official Carroll Shelby documentary with Carroll Shelby's company and family. You know, and then we're doing another one on KRLQ, which is the radio station where Adam and Jimmy Kimmel started. We're doing that with Jimmy Kimmel. You know,
That, I like to hear that as well, because that's got nothing to do with cars.
Yep.
And so what you're describing as a little niche. I don't know how to say it. Niche.
Yep. Niche.
Niche. Little niche. What you're describing as a niche, I don't think it's going to be a niche for very long. I think you're going to expand into many different niches. Niche-I probably is the plural for that. So it's really good to hear that your guys are going down this path. I know it's going to be successful. On a personal note, for you, you have another documentary coming out, finished, the Church Boys.
I have another documentary. Yeah, that the Church Boys. I am sort of working on / getting a little bit of financing. That's in a project I've been doing on my own, and it's a labor of love. It's about a Southern California wrestling team that's been kind of a powerhouse in the U.S. for a couple of decades, and I kind of sort of stumbled onto their story through a friend last season, and because it was a very pivotal season in the history of their program. And we shot the documentary, and I pretty much paid for it all myself to shoot it and get it in the can. And it was a really exciting and crazy season. So now I'm out getting finishing funds to finish the editing and get it done. But yeah, that's one I'm doing just, you know, for my love of wrestling and the sport of, you know, just what the sport means to me. It's a great story about, you know, these kids that it's a faith-based wrestling team, and the coach ended up having to work for free this last season because they ran out of money and they were in danger of losing their whole program. And they hadn't been very successful and they hadn't been doing very well for about 4 or 5 years. And this last season, they ended up having 2 state champions and, you know, taking 5th in the state of California, which is incredible because there's thousands and thousands of wrestling teams in the state of California, and they're a tiny school with less than 1,000 students, and they're beating schools with 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10,000 students. So it's a really interesting story, and it had a lot of ups and downs and craziness. So I'm excited to finish it, but it's, you know, still going to be a little while for that one.
Okay, no, we'll have you back when closer to that. So for people who want to, and I say for people who want to, all of our listeners I know are going to go and check out the 24-Hour War. How do they get their hands on that?
Go to chassis.com. You can pre-order it now. And you can also purchase or download Winning the Racing Life of Paul Newman. That's there and available as well. And, you know, that's it. And if you're interested in me, I'm at NateAdams26. Or at NateAdams26 on Instagram and Twitter.
And we'll post a link to that on our site. Nate, thanks a lot for taking the time.
Alan, thank you so much. And just so you guys know, Alan is awesome to work with. I mean, he is like a workhorse, lots of fun, and knows his stuff. He's an amazing still photographer and videographer. We had you did a great job for us on every single shoot, and that's why I always – every time I film in Europe, I always have you back because you do an amazing job.
Well, Nate, I'm going to cry now, man.
All right.
Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot. I promised myself I wasn't going to cry on this one.
I mean, that's right.
Here we are.
It's almost, yeah.
All right, Nate, thanks a lot. Talk to you soon.
Thanks, Alan. Take care.
And we're back.
Yes.
You actually listened to this one ahead of time.
Yeah, I've heard this interview, so let's pretend I just listened along with everybody else.
What
great interview. Great interview. I know I'm a really interesting guy. I really like hearing about sort of how people got to where they got to, and he has a pretty interesting sort of story. So a really, really good interview. You brought it all out.
And follow Nate on check him out at NateAdams26 on Twitter. We'll put a link on our show notes. And check out their new website, chassis.com, chassy.com. That's where you can find the 24-Hour War and their other movies.
Great.
Challenge for next week.
I'm guessing that you already have one.
Well, I think we should revisit Autumn Colors. We tried it in the summer, which was a horrible, horrible error.
Right.
Do you have some Autumn Colors where you are? Or has it all been washed away?
Yeah, well, it'll be a good question. It's something I will try to do. But yeah, everything is very, very wet here. So mm-hmm. I'm not sure how that will render for Autumn Colors. But I will do my best.
That's all we can ask for, Adam.
Yes.
Okay. Websites. Adam, where can people find your stuff?
AdamSchwartz.ca. And I will post some pictures of the Disneyland vacation at some point on our Facebook page, the Two Hosers Facebook.
Look forward to that.
How about your stuff?
For real. I'm just going to post my stuff on your site, too.
Okay.
Just make it simple. One-stop shopping. You can find my stuff at alanatridge.com, the two of us at twohosers.com, where you can find the links. And, yeah, photos. Anything
great.
Else?
Yeah, no, I think that's it.
It's all up there. You find it there at twohosers.com. And that's it. Until next week, get out there and make better photos.